Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Paul Krugman, who is a columnist for the New York Times and the author of a new book, The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. He also teaches economics at Princeton University. And we'll be talking to him about the Bush administration, given that Paul Krugman has been one of the most erudite and effective critics of the Bush administration in the mainstream press, and we'll be talking to him shortly. We'll also go to Dubai in the Gulf and speak with Yusuf Ibrahim, who's a 25-year veteran Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. He's attending an economic summit in Dubai. He was recently in Iraq, and he's now working as a consultant in the oil business, and we'll be talking to him about, sometime before the Gulf, this recent war in Iraq. Yusuf Ibrahim on this program predicted that the United States would have a quick victory followed by a slow defeat, and it appears that we may have to revise that scenario to the extent it looks like a quick victory followed by a quick defeat. So we'll be talking to doing an update with Yusuf Ibrahim, and then in the last segment of the program, we'll go to Israel and talk with Yuri Averny, who's the founder of Gush Shalom, which is a peace group. Of course, peace seems to be far from the roadmap that President Bush has tried to get together with the former Palestinian prime minister and the current Israeli prime minister, Ariel Sharon. So we'll be getting a sense of whether there is a way out, at least if the Israeli left, not unlike the American left, can regain some political power in Israel. I'm speaking with Paul Krugman, who is an op-ed columnist for the New York Times and the author of a new book, The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. Recently, Paul Krugman, I spoke with Nobel laureate George Akerlof, who suggested that President Bush was the worst president in something like 200 years of American history. But he also went on to say that he felt that the Bush administration were effectively squandering the nation's economic seed corn, and that we were going to pay for it later. Also this week, the head of the GAO, David Walker, had a press conference at which he suggested similarly that the deficits were a millstone around the economy and it was unsustainable over the long term. So my question is, are the Bush people sort of reckless ideologues in terms of free market fundamentalism, and are they just misguided? Or is there a method to their madness, to the extent to which by creating these massive deficits at the end of the day, they will break the public sector in terms of Social Security and Medicare and essentially leave Americans to the mercies of the private sector?
Well, first off, I don't think you want to call the Bushies free market fundamentalists. They may talk about free markets, but they actually have interesting habit of intervening, not on behalf of the of ordinary people who may lose out from the market, but on behalf of corporations and their friends. So the Clinton administration was actually much better at the free market thing than the Bush administration is.
But surely, Paul Krugman, that gets to the heart of much of the hypocrisy of the Republican Party, and the extent to which, if you go to the election map where you have the blue on the coasts and the red in the middle, the red in the middle that votes Republican is largely sustained by farm subsidies and other socialist programs, aren't they?
That's right. It turns out that the states that they picture themselves as Marlboro Man, but in fact they're largely living on welfare from productive states like New Jersey. There's also quite a lot of, this is not an administration of businessmen. They like to say we've got lots of CEOs in the administration, but in fact, yes, they are CEOs or were CEOs, but almost always of companies which depended crucially upon government favors. So this is the access capitalist or crony capitalist administration, not the free market capitalist administration. But to get to your major point about the taxes, everyone who's looked at the numbers seriously, honestly, comes to the conclusion that it's a that it's completely unsustainable, that there's a fundamental mismatch between the revenue coming in and the promises the government has made. Mm-hmm. So it is unsustainable. Now, Does Bush understand that? Does he have a master plan? Probably not. But the people behind him do. And they do view this as a way of depriving the government of the revenue it needs to have all those nasty social programs.
So this is not unlike what Senator Moynihan used to accuse the Reagan administration of, which was that they run up a deficit by relieving the tax burden on the rich, placing it on the middle class, increasing defense spending, creating a massive deficit, which then becomes a compulsory servicing of the debt, becomes the second biggest item on the budget after defense. And in effect, since the rich own the debt and the poor, overtaxed middle class have to service the debt, it's in effect a form of double taxation.
Well, I won't try to argue the details. Basically, the debt is part of it. The main point is simply that we have the government as we know it, federal government as we know it, takes around 20% of GDP. That's what you need, the gross domestic product. That's what it takes to have Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid, defense, and the basic operation of the government. That's just there's always some fat, but there's nothing much in there. The Bush administration has undertaken a series of tax cuts that leave us with a tax base of about 16% of gross domestic product. So we're about 25% down. There's some rounding error in there, but basically we're about 25% down from what we would need just to maintain the basic programs we now have. And that's their aim is to create facts. It's not so much, yes, they'll build up a debt, but equally important or more important, in order to avoid having to do drastic cuts in basic middle-class programs, we would have to have what would be a substantial tax increase from the level at which Bush will leave it. And that's intended to be politically impossible.
And these calculations of yours don't include the extra spending on the war in Iraq.
That's right. The numbers I've worked with most recently are based on a level of military and other spending as it was as of what we knew in around April. Iraq is a significant additional burden. Of course, it depends on how long it goes on. But put it this way, the Iraq venture, just on its budget side, perfectly illustrates the style. It's bait and switch. You have an apparent victory. You have a big flashy landing on an aircraft carrier with the president dressed up in funny clothes. You say, let's have a tax cut. That's what to reward the president for his triumph. And then afterwards, he says, oh, by the way, there's $87 billion, and, of course, we can't possibly consider rolling back any of the tax cut to pay for it.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Paul Krugman, who's the columnist for The New York Times and the author of a new book, The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century, also teaches at Princeton University. So the question still begs, though, is, and also the GAO had recently echoed some of what George Akerlof was saying a couple of weeks ago on this program, we've got the boomlet of the baby boomers coming along here. So rather than this profligacy, we actually should be planning for a huge nut that's coming down the pike. So
that's right. Any reasonable standard of prudence would say that the first decade of the 21st century is our last best chance to avoid a nasty fiscal crunch when the baby boomers hit Medicare and Social Security, and it's that's one reason why the deficit numbers are worse than they seem, because it's one thing to run a deficit in 1983, as Ronald Reagan did, when baby boomers wouldn't be retiring for 30 years. That same deficit is a much more clear and present danger in 2003, when the baby boomers are going to be hitting the retirement programs in just 8 or 9 years.
But is this a deliberate cynical strategy? In other words, to put a stake through the heart of what's left of President Roosevelt and the Great Society. In other words, when it comes to the baby boomers getting their Social Security, there won't be anything in the till. Sorry, guys, you're going to have to go to the private sector.
Well, of course, if you ask current administration officials, they'll say absolutely not. This is not our plan. But fortunately, there are We can look at the lobbyists behind them and the think tanks behind them and ask what they say. And they're quite open and explicit. There's a man named Grover Norquist. We all should know him, his name much better. He's the most powerful lobbyist in Washington. His formal position doesn't matter. He's the man who controls a lot of the right-wing money, dictates a large part of the agenda of this administration and of Republicans in Congress. And he's said, well, I don't want to eliminate the government. I just want to shrink it down to a size where I can drown it in the bathtub. And then you ask, how does he intend to do that? And his answer is not by tackling the programs directly, no frontal assault on Social Security, but by draining the government of its lifeblood, by cutting taxes to the point where those programs can no longer be afforded. So it's that explicit. And he's not the only one. He just happens to be more colorful. So people sometimes say, oh, it's conspiracy theory, but it's not. These guys are quite out in the open.
Well, but this one of my puzzlements, Paul Krugman, having come from Australia and spent a lot of time in Europe, I've seen how other Western democracies operate. And the United States is the only Western democracy where the people are totally disconnected from democracy to the extent to which they don't connect voting with getting something back from the government. And throughout the rest of the democracies, you actually get something back for your government. You get 6 weeks vacation, you get pregnancy leave, health care, childcare, etc. And you vote for people who give you something, and if they don't give it to you, you vote them out. So in order to understand why Grover Norquist could be successful, it seems to me that the heart of the problem is this peculiar disconnect in American democracy, where the public, in effect, don't seem to expect anything from the government.
Well, partly there are a couple of different angles to this. One is simply that they've been heavily propagandized, that this is not coming just out of no place. If you had surveyed public attitudes in the United States 25 years ago, they would have been quite different. This is the product of extensive advertising campaigns, constant berating of the media. Just we're talking about a coordinated effort involving right-wing foundations, think tanks, media organizations, et cetera.
Well, you can also say that George W. Bush essentially ran on that familiar Reagan-esque platform, which is the problem is Washington, it's big government.
That's right. But he also promised new programs. He promised prescription drug coverage. He promised compassionate conservatism. So he came in basically telling the public it could have it all. I can cut your taxes and at the same time give you new stuff. And the media, for the most part, to their eternal discredit, didn't point out that the things didn't add up. But the other thing is that there is some sense in which this is the theory of the right, that the less government gives, the less people appreciate it, and the easier it is to cut government programs even further. That if you can try to arrange it so that most people never do see the good side of government or see it only obscurely, then they won't understand what taxes are for, and you can keep cutting taxes and keep cutting services. And that's their belief, which I have to say seems to have a lot of justification, is that they can push us into a sort of downward spiral in which the role of government and the benefits it provides to the population are steadily trending downwards.
But this, Paul Krugman, is not in the tradition of the kind of Chamber of Commerce Republican Party. It seems to me that what's missing here in the public debate is the extent to which the Republican Party has been taken over by Christian fundamentalists and free market fundamentalists. All you have to do is look at the head of the House, Tom DeLay. In his last election, which he ran unopposed, essentially, his platform was to declare the United States a theocracy with Jesus Christ as the head of state. He doesn't believe in evolution, etc. Recently I saw Loretta Sanchez on C-SPAN, a local congresswoman, and she said, look, us Democrats in the House don't even matter. They get on without us. And if they get past the filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, which they're likely to do because so many Democratic senators are retiring for various reasons, and then they control the executive branch, you will have this country captured by right-wing radicals.
It's pretty close to being true. One of the things I write about in the new book is that trying to get the attention of moderates and liberals who don't understand how close we are to that kind of scenario. I had written about the really extreme views of Tom DeLay, who is the most powerful man in Congress, and I got back letters from friends, liberals, saying, look, you're being too alarmist. What do we care what some crazy guy in Congress says? I tell them, this is not some crazy guy. This is the man who runs Congress. And it is much further along than most people realize. They have the House is run one party rule, narrow majority for the Republicans, but they exploit it ruthlessly. And one party rule in this case means rule by radicals. Tom DeLay is the man who called a press conference after the Columbine school shootings to say that the reason this happened is because we teach evolution in the schools. That's the second most powerful man in America after Bush. It's pretty awesome stuff. We're not the country, at least politically, we're not the country most of us still think we're in.
So what does it say about the political left here? I mean, I know that in the United States, it's the only democracy in the world that doesn't have full-spectrum politics. The left is largely invisible, but that doesn't mean it's not there.
Well, part of it is inability. I quote my own book, but I talk in the introduction about the difficulty people have after a long period of stability, which we did have politically in this country, the difficulty of admitting to yourself that you face a really radical challenge to the system. And I think that is a large part of it. I think playwright Henry Miller, who said it's the power of audacity. We just, liberals, moderates, just haven't caught on to how big a thing we're dealing with, how big a challenge. There's a tremendous imbalance in money. Obviously, between the sides. There's the rise of the unfair and unbalanced media, which, of course, in an Orwellian way, calls itself exactly what it is not. So you have Fox News and Murdoch newspapers and the Reverend Moon and all of that. So most people don't have a really good sense of what's going on. I don't have a complete political theory of what's happening, but it's clear that there's a concerted, organized attack on our institutions by a group of people and group of institutions that are have been working on this for several decades.
But it would seem to me, though, Paul Krugman, that there's some basic ammunition here to blunt them, apart from the fact that they're looting the treasury and leaving, the social contract implied in Social Security. It's that if it's not there when you paid for it, that is wholesale theft. But in terms of the Christian fundamentalism, the delay and this core group of radicals that seem to be running the Republican Party, I mean, Jesus himself did not carry an assault rifle. He didn't hate homosexuals. He didn't picket outside of prisons celebrating capital punishment. He didn't fly around in Learjets and didn't ask for money every 10 seconds on television.
All I can say is, just as someone who reads a lot of history, religion seems to be something that can be used to justify many, many different positions.
Well, but in America, religion for winners. I mean,
well, that seems to be what's happening. It is you had this recent appalling vote in Alabama where there was an attempt to raise some more money for education and in the process fix a truly atrocious tax system. That state imposes quite heavy taxes on poor people and very little on rich people. And you had some Christian groups supporting the proposed change that would somewhat reform that system, but you had others vehemently opposing it, saying basically that cutting taxes on poor people is unchristian. So what can you say?
Mm. Let me again remind the audience, if I may, that I'm speaking with Paul Krugman, who's a columnist for the New York Times and the author of a new book, The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. Just this week, Paul Krugman, Forbes magazine came out with its ranking of the 400 wealthiest people in the United States, and it's very clear that the super rich are getting richer and that the total net worth of America's wealthiest people rose 10%. in the last since the last Forbes 400 right. richest. So what explains this kind of inexorable disparity between the rich and the poor in this country? And apparently the United States has the dubious distinction of being the country where this disparity is growing and is the greatest.
Well, yes. I mean, just a point about the facts of the case. We still envision ourselves as being a middle-class society, the kind of society we were for about 35 or 40 years after World War II.
Well, of course, President Bush gave these taxes to the middle class, remember?
Right. Well, that's what he insisted, except the numbers don't... That's what the budget... What the Comptroller General said when they asked him. But Bush says he's a deficit hawk, and he said, well, you couldn't tell that by looking at the numbers. And I'd say the same thing about the tax cuts. Those aren't... If you look at the numbers, those aren't for the middle class. The really important thing is that we have, just in the last 20 years or so, moved back to a level of concentration of wealth, inequality, that is pre-Franklin Roosevelt. If you take a graph of the income distribution in the United States today and lay it on top of a graph of the income distribution for when Warren Harding was president, they match almost exactly. So we're back to Great Gatsby era wealth inequality, back to the Gilded Age, really. Now, why is a question that's there's a lot of dispute about the particulars. It's a lot of economists that are working on this think that to understand the economics here, you really have to understand the social forces. A large part of this increase in disparities represents not supply and demand, but an erosion of norms that used to keep this inequality in check. And the most telling example is pay of CEOs at large corporations. Those wages, CEO pay is not set in a free market. Coming back to our, this is not a free market administration. CEO pay isn't set in a free market. It's set by compensation boards, which are typically appointed by the CEO himself. So that pay, the constraint on that pay is what people think is obscene and outrageous. And 30 years ago, that concern not to appear to be greedy meant that even at the biggest corporations, CEOs made about 40 times as much as the average employee. Now, CEOs at the biggest corporations earn about 1,000 times, I shouldn't say earn, receive about 1,000 times as much as the average employee. So we've just lost all restraint.
And how are the administration and the press is echoing this, saying that the economy is in this recovery and they expect a 5% growth next year? Of course, you know, the Democrats were kind of counting on running against the Bush economy. Where's the beef here in this argument?
Well, just to be step outside politics for a moment, I just want to... In terms of the sheer economics, I am an economics professor, among other things, the numbers on the economy now are just weird. And I suspect that that's the... I don't think the numbers are being fudged, but if you look at indicators of output, they are up. It is what you would call a recovery. If you look at jobs, the situation is continuing to deteriorate. As far as next year's politics, if this continues, I don't think most voters care about GDP. That's not what they experience in their daily lives. What they see is whether or not they have a job. And I think the job situation continues to look extremely grim. Crucial point, I think we should say, is that even if there is some recovery in jobs, Bush will be the first president since Herbert Hoover to end a term with fewer people working than at the beginning. So it is a pretty grim economy. But even if it were to truly recover, even if we were to get unemployment down significantly, it would still be an economy burdened with tremendous, rapidly growing debt and with a level of inequality, which means that prosperity is increasingly shared by only a few people.
And you have to add into this open-ended commitment in Iraq. The president has put this country at war for very, very dubious and ill-explained, inadequately explained reasons. And it does seem that this war is a complete... in fact, it looks as though they've already lost it. We're already whistling past the graveyard here. There's no way out. I understand that Karl Rove is desperately looking for an exit strategy, and perhaps, you know, next at the Republican convention in New York next year, they will declare a victory and say the boys and girls will be home by Christmas. But I don't think the facts on the ground. I think reality bites in this case.
Well, not my field of expertise, but apparently not their field of expertise either. Wow. No, I mean I just every morning check the news and just. I think, I have spoken to some people, not currently in the military, but recently out, and they just, everyone is just aghast. You know, I have learned that the people, there were a group of people in the first Bush administration who were viewed dismissively, apparently by Bush 1 and the senior officials as the crazies. And the crazies are actually running foreign policy in this administration, those same people. And they're doing all the things that that Daddy explained carefully would be really stupid to do. And here we are.
Well, do you think, though, that, you know, a lot of people see this this unraveling of the Iraq misadventure in terms of instead of the soldiers being greeted with roses and like the liberation of Paris in 44, this is the being shot in the back and more every day. And it's looking like a Vietnam on fast forward. And there's some indication that Cheney's already on the outs. But there's also, I mean, Ambassador Joseph Wilson, Mr. Yellowcake, as he calls himself.
Yeah.
He said, just in an op-ed piece this week, that he said maybe the neocons are not as crazy as they look, and maybe there's some method to their madness, the extent to which Iraq is now destabilized. It may break into three. It may have a civil war. There may be a broader war between the Sunni and the Shia. But the bottom line is that the destabilization of Iraq will mean that all the Arab neighbors are preoccupied with this. And if there's a broader war between Shiism and Sunniism, then the Arabs are completely at war with themselves, and therefore the Likud party in Israel wins. I mean,
I think that's ascribing too much foresight. I think these guys really thought that whiff of grape shot, and they would be able to install their guy Ahmad Chalabi, they'd all live happily ever after, and they'd be free to go on to the next war. I don't think they envisioned anything like this. And for what it's worth, while there are a lot of people in the administration who are, if you want to say, very, very closely allied with Sharon and his party in Israel, there are also a lot of people in this administration with very close personal and business ties to Saudi Arabia, which includes the Bush family itself. And the Saudis are not looking forward to the scenario you just described. That's very close to their worst nightmare. I think this is a genuine screw up.
Well, on that note, I thank you, Paul Krugman, for joining us.
Thank you.
And for your new book, The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. I was just speaking then with Paul Krugman, who is a columnist with The New York Times and the author of The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. He also teaches economics at Princeton University. I'm now speaking with Yusuf Ibrahim, who's a 25-year veteran Middle East correspondent with The New York Times, and he is now in Dubai at an economic summit. And Yusuf Ibrahim, do you subscribe to the theory that I mentioned to Paul Krugman, that Ambassador Wilson mentioned in an op-ed piece this week, that perhaps there's a cynical motive that this misadventure in Iraq by the Bush administration is not such a screw-up after all? Maybe the neocons intended Iraq to fall apart, to put all of the Iraq's neighbors in destabilize them, and perhaps even generate a wider war between Sunnis and Shiism, which would then completely destabilize the Gulf and the Arab world.
I subscribe to parts of it. The neoconservative group, including the American Enterprise Institute, Heritage Foundation, were talking about this as being the first chapter in an adventure that would change the entire Middle East. Of course, they put the label of democracy on it and free enterprise. We would go in there, we would free the oil sector and then destroy OPEC and bring democracy to Iraq, and it would be contagious. There is an element, a conspiratorial element there. To what degree does this match with the interest of Israel is a matter of conjecture, but at any rate...
Well, I think you have to qualify that, don't you, Yusuf? It's not so much Israel, it could, because the charge...
It is a coalition of neoconservative, evangelical Christians, and pro-Likud, the pro-Likud lobby, which is a minority, really, within the American Jewish community. I think the majority of the American Jewish community, if we were left alone without manipulation, is primarily belongs to the Democratic Party and is primarily liberal and part of the Peace Now movement. So that group, that coalition, this trilateral coalition, did have very fanciful ideas about changing the whole region. And of course, what we are seeing now is that it is falling apart, and it's proved to be a catastrophe in the making.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Yusuf Ibrahim, who is with the Council for Foreign Relations and Managing Director of SEIG, Strategic Energy Investment Group, and you're at the Economic Summit in Dubai. I take it, I imagine, Yusuf, that Iraq has to be a rather animated topic of conversation, surely.
Animated the topic of conversation, yes, but without resolution. Everybody here is still very guarded about committing themselves in terms of actual dollars. There has been a lot of talk in the last 2 days, and there will be more talks tomorrow about helping Iraq, but it is quite clear that until the situation in the United Nations is resolved in a fashion that the European Union, i.e. old Europe, that is to say Germany and France, like to see it, no real money is going to be coming forth. Everybody is agreed to the fact that the Iraqi situation has got to be redressed. The disagreement is under whose command, and until the United Nations is involved, I don't think even after these IMF World Bank meeting, you will see a serious commitment of money from the world community, and it is still us, the United States, who will be left with the bill, which is now on the scale of $1.2 billion per week. And in fact, yesterday, some of the participants said that they are all waiting for the Madrid donors conference to make commitments. And I suspect even then, if there is not a resolution that the French and the Germans accept, they may not veto it, but they will go along with it and not fork out the money. So the United States is still left paying the big bill.
But Yusuf Ibrahim, I'm getting the impression, and I may be wrong, but it seems to me that those that are seeking to undermine the U.S. occupation seem to continually have the initiative with the picking off the soldiers on a daily basis, blowing up the Jordanian embassy, blowing up the U.N. compound, blowing up the mosque, the most sacred to the Shia. Almost assassinating and gravely wounding one of the members of the Iraqi Governing Council, and sabotaging the oil pipelines on a constant basis. So you get the impression that the nation-building part is never getting off the dime, because the security situation seems to be not improving.
It is not improving. If anything at all, it is getting worse by the day, because the segments and the sectors you just outlined are all being attacked. First it was U.S. troops, then it was expanded to United Nations. Therefore, the United Nations now is very hesitant, and Kofi Annan is becoming, the Secretary General of the UN is becoming a hardliner on cooperating with the United States because he is worried about his staff. After all, some of his best friends and closest assistants were killed in this bombing. And then every time they announce that the pipeline to Turkey is ready to go and has been turned on, somebody blows it up. So, I mean, you're looking at a country which has the second largest oil reserves in the world after Saudi Arabia, which has to import oil products, including gasoline and diesel, to run generators and that sort of thing. That is not at all what we had in mind when we went in there. I mean, they're supposed to be pumping oil. Before the war, they were pumping 3 million barrels a day of oil. Today, they'll be lucky if they're pumping 700,000. The refineries are completely destroyed. Therefore, they're not refining the oil and producing gasoline and fuel oil, et cetera, et cetera. That's a great irony, but it also is a testimony to one of the biggest failures ever in terms of enterprises. This invasion was not studied at all. The aftermath of it was not studied. And I just was in Iraq. It is very sad to see that the American troops are beginning to be garrisoned everywhere. In other words, they are islands surrounded by hostile Iraqis. Not in the north of Iraq, but certainly in the center of Iraq. And in the south of Iraq, there is the great menace of Iran, which we are now again harassing. That is to say, the neoconservatives are beginning to talk about Iran again and trying to impose sanctions on Iran and sanctions on Syria. That's really asking for even more trouble, because these countries share borders with Iraq, from which a significant amount of infiltration could happen if they wish it to happen. We have every interest now in pacifying Iran, working with it, every interest in pacifying Syria, working with it. Otherwise, the situation is only going to get worse. There is a huge silent majority of Iraqis that has not taken sides yet, but seeing their daughters raped or menaced every night, not being able to go out in the street, having their cars hijacked, is turning the silent majority slowly into a recruiting pool of anti-Americans.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Yusuf Ibrahim, who's in Dubai at an economic summit conference. He's with the Council on Foreign Relations and the managing director of SEIG, Strategic Energy Investment Group. What about Qasr, though, Yusuf Ibrahim? You mentioned the oil pipelines in the north to Turkey being constantly sabotaged, but I understand oil is coming through from the fields in the south around Basra. Where is that oil going, and are they getting any revenues from it?
Yes, it is. I mean, this all the oil that is coming out of Iraq is being shipped on boats and going. But we don't have enough transparency there. And there is enough to believe that some of this oil is being sold at far below the world price. And there is a lot of, as it happened in Russia after the Soviet Union collapsed, there is a lot of hanky-panky going on there. The American troops are not in control. The British troops are not in control. A lot of this oil is being stolen and smuggled and sold to Kuwait and other places at half prices, from which it's re-exported as though it was Iraqi oil or Iranian oil. Therefore, the amount of revenues that Iraq itself is getting from this oil is questionable, and it's certainly not the full amount that it needs. Anyway, no matter how you calculate it, even if you accept that Iraq is exporting 700,000 barrels a day, that's hardly 6 or $7 billion a year. That's a drop of water in a sea of needs, and it cannot in any way be a basis for the reconstruction of Iraq. You're talking about a country that needs $100 to $150 billion to rebuild its infrastructure, its electricity, its water, its refineries, and its society. And what is coming in now is a trickle. When you talk to the Americans there, you talk to the American army itself, they will tell you, we don't have money to rebuild the country. Forget all the grand announcements that you hear from the Bush administration about the schools and this and that coming back. The country is in dire need of money, and it has essentially no source of revenue now because the oil industry has not come back to life, and it is not going to come back to life under these circumstances of guerrilla warfare, resistance, blowing up the pipelines, and the refineries being looted as they are being looted.
And Yusuf Ibrahim, it's hard to believe that that it could be as bad as this, and that it could have turned so sour so quickly, given that the United States did liberate Iraq from that dreadful regime. But the $87 billion that President Bush just asked for, which brings it up to a total of $166 billion, 90% of that is for the military and for the security situation. So you're saying that an equal amount needs to be done, is spent on infrastructure, and instead of $150 billion, we're lucky that a $10 billion is going to be allocated. So again, I just am left with this sense that this is a complete disaster, and there's no way it's going to be good for America, good for the Middle East, and good for the world.
Well, it isn't, and the most distressing thing about all of this, Ian, is that we many of us said so before. We said, before you go into this war, you better have an exit plan. What's your plan B? It is very easy to defeat the Iraqi army. It's absolutely unable to stand up to the United States. But you go in there and you disband an army of 250,000 people, suddenly depriving 250,000 families of an income. And these people know how to use guns, how to use bombs, how to fight back. And what you get is what you see. They fight back. In addition to this, I have never seen an administration such as the Bush administration that has managed to turn the widespread admiration worldwide for the United States. I mean, the world loved the United States and what it stood for into utter and complete hostility. The United States is extremely unpopular in this part of the world where I am now, and that includes the friends, the former friends of the United States, the ruling classes, the emirs, and the working class and the Arab street. In other words, we've managed to really alienate just about everybody. The arrogance of the Bush administration and the neoconservative in addressing the world, and the refusal of the Bush administration up until now to concede at least that it has to work with other countries if it wishes to have their cooperation, only guarantees that what is a quagmire with a Vietnam flavor is going to be a quagmire with a Soviet flavor, as in Afghanistan. We have not managed to do the nation building in Afghanistan. In fact, the Taliban are making a comeback. If anything at all, we are discovering Al-Qaeda as a much bigger organization than we ever thought it to be. And in Iraq, we are repeating the mistake in the same way. I mean, every day the American army surrounds Iraqi villages, picks up, enters homes, humiliates men in front of their family, and then they retreat and hardly find any weapons. And yet, a minute later, they are attacked. Today, 3 soldiers were killed in a convoy. We have 6,000, 7,000 seriously wounded people there, and we don't talk about the wounded because people think wounded is like, you know, not a big deal. Wounded could mean you've lost your legs, or you've lost your hands, or you're paralyzed for life. Now, in whose name has the Bush administration given itself the authority to offer American lives this way. I mean, we didn't give the Bush administration a mandate to kill so many innocent Americans and, along with them, a lot of innocent Iraqis, making Iraq itself a very hostile environment. It is a disaster. I have rarely seen a bunch of the best and the brightest get into such a quagmire since Vietnam.
I thank you very much for joining us from Dubai, Yusuf Ibrahim.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Yusuf Ibrahim, who's a 25-year veteran, Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. He's now an oil consultant. He's also with the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's attending the economic summit in Dubai, in the Gulf. I'm now speaking with Yuri Averny, who is an activist with Gush Shalom, which is a peace group in Israel. And clearly, Yuri, events in the last few weeks have spiraled out of control, it seems, at least in terms of a roadmap that was laid down recently by President Bush, the former Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority, Abu Abbas, who is no longer there, and Ariel Sharon. As an Israeli, do you believe that your leaders sincerely want peace?
Mr. Sharon does not want peace. If peace means that we give up the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, that is quite clear. He wants to have under Israeli control all the country which used to be called Palestine, and to settle Jewish settlers on the land of all the country. And if peace means that they cannot do that, he certainly does not want peace.
And how many people in Israel have your outlook? Because obviously, if you believe that this man doesn't want peace, then you know that this is going nowhere, except, as Colin Powell says, off a cliff.
Well, you know, Ariel Sharon is presenting himself as a man of peace. He repeats it all the time that he's ready to make painful concessions for peace, and people believe him. It's like the Pied Piper. The public opinion polls in Israel, all of them, show that the general public, the great majority, is ready to pay the price demanded for peace. Yet they have been convinced that peace is impossible because the Palestinians do not want peace. And therefore they are ready to entrust their fate to the hands of Ariel Sharon. Ariel Sharon looks like a forceful leader. He has a lot of charisma. And people support peace and support Sharon without being conscious of the contradiction between the two.
Well, also, you have to add to this that the Palestinians appear to reflexively support the Israeli rejectionist argument, because, you know, you've got Abbas saying he wants peace, but then you've got Arafat undermining him behind the scenes, and you've got Hamas and...
Well, that is complete nonsense.
Uh-huh.
Excuse me for saying so. This is complete nonsense. This is an American legend created by our own propaganda, and we, in the end, we are believing our own propaganda.
Go ahead dispute it.
Yasser Arafat is the elected leader of the Palestinian people. He is the man who made the peace of Oslo. He has not wavered from this path in any direction. He offers Israel peace on the conditions which have been laid down and which have not been changed in the last 30 years, I might say. And what happened to Abbas, Abu Mazen, was very simple. He's been appointed by the Americans and the Israelis. The Palestinians have accepted him because they believe that if he is prime minister, he will get concessions from the Americans and the Israelis. And after 2 months, they realize that he has got nothing at all, not one little thing at all from the Americans and from the Israelis. So they kicked him out again. That's the whole story.
Now, why is it that your version is not the preeminent one, and that in America, where many people think that Israel has inordinate influence through AIPAC in the Congress, why is it that the Likud version of reality is the one that most Americans have?
Because the only source of information is Israeli, is the Sharon government propaganda in America and in Israel too. Do you ever hear the Palestinian side of the story? Do you ever hear about the Israeli peace movement? Do you even know that an Israeli peace movement exists? When has the New York Times for the last time mentioned the activity of the Israeli peace movement, which goes on every day? Only yesterday we had a big demonstration in Tel Aviv for peace. Was it mentioned in the New York Times or the Washington Post or any of the other papers in the United States? You don't hear about it. So what can the average citizen in the United States and in Israel, for that matter, what can he believe in? When did you read, very simple questions to you and to your, all your listeners, when did you read or hear for the last time one positive word about Yasser Arafat? 20 years ago? 30 years ago?
Well, I actually read
the
other
day. The elected leader of the Palestinian people, so totally bad, so absolutely evil, the man who has been elected and who's supported today by every single Palestinian, can he be so evil that there's not one single thing you can say, good thing you can say about him?
Well, in fact, one thing that did...
It's brainwashing.
I understand. And I think you can make the argument that one of the reasons why Israel can't get off the dime here and make any progress is that the Israeli lobby ends up talking to itself. They're so effective that they've created a feedback loop where they basically are negotiating with themselves. And the American administration doesn't have the cojones, as they say here, to do anything about it. But...
I don't think that the Jewish lobby is the main factor here. There's a Christian lobby, which is by far worse.
Right.
The Christian fundamentalists.
Yeah, but they're in alliance with
lobby,
the...
which are dominating Washington, as far as I can see.
Right, but
they're more extreme than the Jewish lobby.
I understand, but they're in alliance with Likud. I mean, my problem is...
They're totally allied to the Likud, and even worse. Mm. The most extreme... anti-peace elements in Israel are supported by this Christian American lobby and the Jewish lobby. This is a very big force.
Well, most American Jews are liberal. They want peace. I mean, this is where I don't understand why how the right wing have usurped Israel's voice here in the United States.
It's the same story as over here. The people, the Jews in America generally, and the people in Israel generally, really are liberal and want peace. For some reason, which is difficult to explain, American Jewish life is dominated by the worst right-wing anti-peace elements. People ask who elected them. I don't think any one of these so-called leaders have ever been elected by the Jewish community. There are no elections in the Jewish community. They've been appointed by someone, perhaps the Israeli embassy. Mm. Now, this difference between what ordinary American Jews believe in and what their leadership represents is duplicated here in Israel, because it's the same here. As we said before, the great majority really wants peace and is ready to pay the price for peace, which is more important. They are ready to give back the whole of the occupied territories. They don't care a damn for them. They are ready to take back all the settlers from there. Mm-hmm. They are ready to see a Palestinian state, a state of Palestine, next to the state of Israel. Yet our leadership is going in the opposite direction. There is no political opposition in Israel to speak of. The Labor Party, which is supposed to be the opposition, has practically ceased to exist.
Sounds like the Democratic Party here in the United States.
Very similar. I don't know. With all the huge difference between the United States and Israel in size and history and whatever, there's an uncanny similarity between the political facts over there and here.
Well, you know, there was a quote, though, in the Los Angeles Times this week from Yossi Beilin, the former justice minister, the chief negotiator for Oslo. Mm-hmm. He's apparently a close friend of the new prime minister, that the Karai, Abu Allah. Abu Allah apparently told Yossi Beilin, he said, look, if I were to announce a peace deal with the Israelis, my neighbors would kill me. They're my closest friends, but they would kill me.
If he would do what?
Announce a peace plan. He said he would have no credibility, and he'd be dead in 5 minutes. Whereas if Yasser Arafat were to announce a peace agreement with the Israelis, people would be cheering in the streets and throwing flowers.
Yes.
So how do you explain that? And how come the Americans and the Israelis just can't sort of, marginalizing Arafat and making him irrelevant, they've clearly gotten nowhere. Is there any way that they can just get off the dime here and face reality? Because Arafat clearly has the support of his people, and if anybody can deliver peace, he can, and they're just casting around here in the dark looking for a puppet who has no credibility.
Yasser Arafat is the father of the nation. He is, for the Palestinians, what George Washington was to Americans. Now when he is in danger of being assassinated any moment by Sharon, the whole Palestinian people, without exception, from the extreme right to the extreme left, the whole people have rallied around him, as any other people would. And I was there the last Saturday, in his compound, his Mukata. I was there. Abu Allah was there, by the way. Abu Allah is very close to Arafat. Mm-hmm. And it was obvious to anyone that he enjoys, Yasser Arafat enjoys a total confidence and trust and even love of his people. And the more Americans and Israelis threaten him, and Mr. Bush says he's failed as a leader. I don't know if Mr. Bush has been so successful as a leader, so to enable him to criticize other leaders, I doubt it very much. But Mr. Bush totally dismissing Arafat, and Mr. Sharon trying to kill him, this has made him even more popular. He's never been, I think, I know Mr. Arafat for 30 years. I don't think he ever was so popular among the Palestinians and enjoyed their support so much. And he's in such good spirits as he is now.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Avernik. This is a point of view that is not often heard here in the United States media, and I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Yuri Averni, who's the founder of Gush Shalom, which is an Israeli peace group. I thank Mark Maxwell, the engineer today. I also thank Louis Vandenberg for research and production. You can always hear this program at ianmasters.org. That's ianmasters.org. And past programs are also archived on that website. Again, ianmasters.org. I thank you all for joining us. Bye.